Okay, it's recording. So, my name is Scout Fletcher, and I'm 17 years old, and I'm speaking with my grandfather, Ronald Higginbotham. And so, I guess we're going to start with the first question is, where were you born? Where were you born, and what was your childhood like?
I was born in Greenport, Long Island, New York. My parents were both from Alabama. But they moved up to New York during the Depression to get jobs. And Dad got a job in a potato farm on Long Island. Well, that's where I was born. And my childhood, I don't remember anything about Long Island. We lived out there for a couple of years, I think, then moved into Connecticut, I think. I remember a little bit about Connecticut. I remember riding on it. My mother was close on a sled in the snow to go to the grocery store. And I think I started school in Connecticut, but then we moved to New Jersey. And I remember a little bit more about New Jersey. I lived there until age 7 or something. I remember when the war ended, 1941, I think. That'd be about right. 1941, the war ended. I remember everybody going outside, blowing horns and beating on trash cans, just making a lot of noise, celebrating the war was ended. Well, that was World War II. So I started school in Passaic, New Jersey, and I remember growing up there. And then when I was 13, we moved to Marietta, Georgia. That's where I went to middle school. Mm-hmm. And started high school while we lived in Marietta, Georgia. Started high school. And I didn't start high school. We lived in Marietta for a few years. Then we, at the age of 13, we moved to New Orleans. My dad had a transfer. He was working with Shell Oil Company. We moved to New Orleans for my dad's job. And I finished grammar school and started my first 2 years of high school in a Catholic high school in New Orleans. How far did I want to go? That was about 1952 when we left New Orleans.
Yeah, that's good. I guess just, like, did you like going to school as a kid or no? Like,
I liked it pretty well, yeah.
Yeah. And then, you kind of already said some of it, but what were your parents like, sort of, when you were growing up?
They were just really kind, hardworking people. Dad had a good job. He worked all. He loved his job. He loved his job. No matter what he did, he just loved his job. He'd come home from work when we were young. He'd come home from work with a suit and tie on. He'd keep the shirt and suit down while he mowed the lawn with a push lawnmower. He loved being dressed up. I guess it's because he grew up in pretty humble beginnings when he was young in Alabama. His father was a coal miner, and my mother's father was a coal miner, too, in Alabama. And the pretty lowly beginnings. Mother grew up in an immigrant family. Her mother and father immigrated. Mother came over from Germany with her parents. Yeah. Her father was well, they're both German. Frank Schultz and Maria Schultz, they came to the States with their young children, mother left with mother. So mother grew up, I don't think she really spoke much German. She understood some, but then she just never did speak German after that, so she didn't have an understanding of the German language. Mm-hmm. But they were good grandparents, kind of real old school, old country. But my mother and father were very caring and supportive of us. In fact, over the years, as I told friends about my dad, how much my dad thought about me, they said, Ron, nobody had a great dad as wonderful as your dad was. He was a pretty wonderful dad. He's always had positive things to say about us. He thought we were the best boys in the world. And just gave us a lot of self-confidence. So I love my dad and what he did for me and my mother, too. They're good, supportive parents.
Yeah. What about, like, do you have any memories of, like, any favorite memories of my mom when she was a kid?
Yeah. She was a lot of fun. When she was pretty young, we lived on the Douglas Lake Indian Reserve. And she was probably about 1 year old when we moved there. But she wore a dress and leggings underneath them and played a lot with the native kids. She went to kindergarten right over the Indian reservation where we lived. Mm-hmm. But next door to us is a kindergarten teacher hired by the Indian band to teach kindergarten. So Rachel went to that kindergarten. Her brother did too. And one day Rachel came home, she said, Mom, do we know any Indians? And Emma said, yes, everybody you know is an Indian. She said, there's an Indian reservation. Rachel didn't know we're living on an Indian reservation because that's where she was brought up, you know, just, mm-hmm. just everyday life for her. She's a lot of fun.
How did you guys end up living on the Indian reservation?
How did we?
Yeah.
Well, we were committed to be Christian missionaries,
mm-hmm.
and we prayed by direction. God directed us to British Columbia, and first we went up there to be summer missionaries to try it out. I think that's where Rachel was born, and Timothy was. No, Rachel. I think that was before Rachel was born. Timothy was about two when we moved up there to be summer missionaries,
mm-hmm.
and we spent 6 weeks on an Indian reservation in British Columbia with a little boy, Timothy, and it was kind of a rugged situation, but we just felt that's where God wants to be. We called other people about making a move. So we got permission to move on to the Douglas Lake Indian Reserve, which is 30 miles away from the town of Merritt, B.C. Merritt's about 7,000 population, and Douglas Lake is a 30-mile drive outside of Merritt. First 17 miles, I think, were on paved road, and the last 13 miles on a dirt and gravel road.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew that we could move up there if we had a mobile home. So we bought a mobile home with the idea that we'd want to move on the reservation as close as we could. And I asked the chief one day if I could move a mobile home on the reserve to live there. He said, sure, where do you want to put it? So he was very open. So we told him we'd like to move on the reserve with a mobile home. And he said, I know a good place for you. We're a good place to put the mobile home. He shows where he would recommend. He said it's near water hookup, where a sewer hookup, and near the center of everything, so that's a perfect spot for us. And I said, what's it going to cost to live there? He said, nothing. He said, nobody's using the land anyway. I said, well, I want to pay for something. I said, some of the people might think we should pay something. He said, well, let me talk to the band council and see what they think. He talked to me about a week later. He said, Ron, how about $25 a month rent? I said, really? So we paid the rent. Every month we write a check for $25 to give it to the chief in the band office, administrative office. Several years later, I said, none of those checks have ever been cashed. That's what happened to him. He went to the band office. They said, we put them all in a cigar box over here. I said, really? I said, what are you going to do them? He said, well, I don't know. Maybe someday we'll buy hockey jerseys for the team. But I said, you'll put a name on the back of the jersey. He said, no, not really. But we loved living there. It was a lot of challenges, a lot of danger, but it was a big experience for us. We sure were out of our element. You know, we were both born, raised in Georgia, and finished college and never lived on an Indian reservation. We had a lot of stories that showed people how much we did not really belong there. We had our water pipe frozen 1 year under our mobile home, and it took me about 3 weeks, I think, to get it all patched up by calling underneath the mobile home. I had to cut through the fiberboard underneath the mobile home, found a leak in the pipe, patched another place. I think about 13 patches I put in the pipe. I went next door to talk to the man that showed me how to patch a frozen pipe. I said, are you proud of me? He said, no. I said, why? I patched all those pipes and it's fixed. He said, yeah, but you should have put a brand new pipe in. He said, now you got a pipe with 13 patches in there. I said, so you don't think I'm pretty smart? He said, Ron, you're the dumbest white man I've ever known. So I told him that would be my Indian name, the dumbest white man. But over and over again, we could see that we didn't know what we were doing up there, but God took care of us and blessed us. And after living there 7 years, I went over to the same man that called me the dumbest white man. I said, Antoine, you call me the dumbest white man. I said, like, I admit this is not the best place for us to live. But I said, do you know anybody up here that's happy as we are? He just looked at the ground. He couldn't say yes, because we knew all the families up there really well. I visited all the homes. I saw all the troubles they faced, and I could see all the bitterness and suicide thoughts and actual suicides and drug use. And, you know, that's not because they're happy. They're just disappointed and had no purpose in life, but we had a real purpose in life. I said, we're happier up here than anyone lives here. And I said, we don't even belong here. I said, do you think you can move your family down to Augusta, Georgia, and live next to the country club where Emily was raised? Could you move down there and be happy? He couldn't say a thing because he knew he could not be happy. And I said, if you did move down there, could you depend on friends on the reservation to send you money every month to pay for all expenses? He knew that wouldn't happen. But I said, that's what we do. I said, we have friends in Georgia. Some of the people we've only known for a few weeks before we moved up here. But they promised to send us $15 a month or $20 a month to mission headquarters for their expenses. And I said, that's how faithful the Christian friends have been. I said, God really bless us. It was a good overall experience, but very challenging. Mm-hmm. Helped us learn more about how wonderful God was, how he provided for our needs, and how he protected us, kept it well. It was a good experience for all of us, I think.
Yeah. Where did you guys move after that?
After 7 years on the Douglas Lake Indian Reserve, we moved to Sechelt, British Columbia, which is up the coast. It's, I think, about 20 miles north of Horseshoe Bay, British Columbia. It's on the BC coast. And we got permission from the chief there to move. No, we did not move on to the reservation. The reservation was right next to the white community, so we bought a home in the white community, and I'd walk about 4 blocks of the reservation every day, visit around from door to door. A lot of days I'd come home and have lunch and go back in the afternoon. Good experience for me there too, and that's where Timothy and Rachel, I think Timothy started high school there. Rachel didn't quite make it to high school there, I don't think, but it was a good experience for us. So we lived there for, I think, for 5 years, I think.
Yeah. When did you have the Coca-Cola job?
That was when I was let's see, I finished high school. Wait, no, let me think. Oh, I started college at Auburn, Alabama, and transferred to Georgia Tech. You know, I was getting ready to graduate from Georgia Tech. I started going to job interviews. And then someone said the Coca-Cola Company was hiring. So I walked down about 4 blocks over the Coca-Cola Company in Atlanta. And I said, I'm looking for employment. And they said, well, do you like to travel? I said, sure, I like to travel. They said, have you had any experience traveling? I said, yes. I said, when I was in high school, I went out to Idaho, took the bus out to Idaho, had a summer job with the Forest Service. And then I came back on the bus to Atlanta. I said, enjoy that traveling, being away from home a lot. So I got hired by the Trade Research Department. Their job is to protect the trademark Coke and Coca-Cola. Both Coke and Coca-Cola are registered trademark names, and they're worth a lot of money. They're probably the best-known trademarks in the world. Mm-hmm. And, well, not right now. Amazon might be, you know, Microsoft might be a bigger name. But Coca-Cola is an important trademark all around the world. In fact, some people that come here from China would say, oh, you have Coca-Cola in America, too? If they thought it was a Chinese drink. But it's such a widespread product, and it's so easy to imitate. You know, you can make any kind of a drink that looks kind of like Coca-Cola, and someone asks for a Coke, you can give it to them, and they might not complain. But they're both registered trademarks with a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So they hired about 15 college graduates full-time to travel through the United States and investigate places that sell Coca-Cola just to help protect the trademark. So I did that job, I think, for 2.5 years. Did really well. Loved all the traveling and saved up some money. At the end of that time, I enrolled in forestry school in Georgia, met Emily, and all the money I saved on the Coca-Cola job, I spent that buying her engagement ring. So money well spent.
Yeah. I didn't know you worked in the foresting thing in Idaho. That's cool.
I did.
What kind of work were you doing up there?
Actually, I lived in Camas, Utah, which is not far from Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Emily and I were married not too long. We moved out to Camas, checked into the Camas Ranger Station. They said, you're going to be working blister rust control. I said, where will we live? They said, there's a little cabin up near, It was up in the highway. But it was Bitter National. No, Wasatch National Forest. We took two little cabins up there. We stayed in the cabin, and the rest of the summer we did blister rust control. Nice job.
That's cool. Do you think you could just tell me about, like, one sort of important person in your life, or, like, influential person?
Sure, my dad, of course, was the most influential.
Yeah.
My dad just thought the world of us. I went on a vision trip with my dad one time. I was home for the summer, and Dad said, how about going with me down to Miami? He said, I've got to call on some show dealers and television studios. Dad was in charge of advertising for show company. He would talk to different television companies and radio stations and advertise, have Shell advertising on television. Go with him once. And I think we're near Miami. We stayed at somebody's house, some TV producer. Dad said, just sit here and eat some popcorn and watch television. So I was. And Dad was in the other room talking to this television station manager. And I needed to get a drink, so I walked back in to get a drink. And Dad was talking about someone who was 6 feet tall, strong, fast, great football player. And I said, Dad, who are you talking about? He said, never mind. You should keep going. He was bragging about me. He made me sound so good I didn't know who he was talking about. But he was just a wonderful dad. He arranged a lot of time with me. I know when I was about grade 10, I think, Dad would say, Ron, come on up back. I was planting these shrubbery in the backyard. I went up back and Dad had the shovel. He said, okay, in a dig hole right here. I started digging. He said, why are you digging it that way? I said, well, how do you want me to dig it? He said, well, okay, keep digging. He just would ask me questions and talk to me. He'd just stand there watching me dig, just with me all the time. He was a real companion. And I appreciate all the time he spent with me. But he made me think I was so good that if someone ever said they didn't think much of me, that didn't bother me too much, but I had a really good self-image about how much my dad thought about me. If someone didn't like me, I'd think, well, they just don't know me really well yet. I'm really a great person. That's what my dad did for me. Gave me a good self-image. So he was a very important person in my life. Mm-hmm. Someone else that meant a lot to me, of course, was when I was almost 13, my Sunday school teacher. He meant a lot to me. He taught me the Bible every week in class and took us on camping trips and whatnot. Mm-hmm. He was a great example to me, too.
Okay, you said you, like, traveled a lot for the Coca-Cola job. Is there, like, a favorite place you've traveled, like, even just in the world, not only with that job?
I've never really traveled much in the world. In fact, Emily and I talked about it the other day, how much our children and grandchildren have been in so many countries, different places. And the only time I ever left the United States was once to go to Cuba for a weekend with my parents. Mm-hmm. That was about a 30-minute ride on plane, I guess, from Miami to Cuba. And then on that Coca-Cola job, I traveled across the border from San Diego and across the border from El Paso, Texas, just 5 miles into Mexico. That's the only travel I've done out of the United States. Mm. And then Emily and I lived for 30 years in British Columbia, so that was the only travel out of the United States. Never been to Spain, never been to Europe, never been to South America. Mm. Well, we've been in Hawaii, that's part of the States, too.
Yeah. Okay. You already kind of said, but can you just tell the story of, like, when you met Nana?
Okay. When I quit the Forest Service, I quit the Coca-Cola job, traveling job as a spy. Mm-hmm. I went back to college to get a degree in forestry. And I went to the University of Georgia since I was from Georgia. Went to the University of Georgia, got admitted to forestry school, and found a couple of boys to room with, and we shared rent for an apartment. And these two boys were part of a group called Interforestry Christian Fellowship, a campus outreach on the campus. So I went to the first meeting, and Nana was not there, but they said, this coming weekend, we're going to have a retreat at Hardlake Creek State Park. And I thought, well, that sounds good. So I went to the retreat, and I forgot who the speaker was now. I remember, Emily helped me remember later. The message was really good. But at the retreat, I was in line in the cafeteria, and I saw this really nice-looking girl up in front of me. She turned around and smiled, and I fell in love with her almost right on the spot. And I found out her name, started talking to her, and I said, could I give you a ride back to campus after the game, after the conference? She said, well, I'd like to do that, but she's already got a ride back to another girl. So I went back by myself. Next week, I called Emily, tried to get a date with her. She said, I'm sorry, I got practice with the swim team. I tried again. She said, I can't do that. I got some water ballet or something. Next thing, she said, I got to study for a final exam. I said, boy, this is getting tough. So then some friends of Emily's invited me over to their house for supper. And they said, could you bring Emily? I said, I'd be glad to. So they had it all set up. So we had a date. It was really great. It was almost love at first sight for me. It took Emily a little bit longer, but we got no love almost right away. And that was, we met on April the 5th, 1963. We celebrate that every year as meeting day, April the 5th. Mexicans have a day they call Cinco de Mayo. We call our meeting day Cinco de Abril, 5th of April. We celebrate that day every year. In fact, even we go to soccer games in the spring season. In the last year, 2 years ago, within the last 2 years, they've had a spring soccer game on April the 5th. We went to Costco and had a big cake made up 2 feet by 3 feet on the top. It said, meeting day, April the 5th, 1963, around Mid-Emily. And so we've celebrated that day. It's been a wonderful day for us. Just remember how God brought us together on April the 5th, 1963. And so just this past month, December 21st, the last year, 2019, was our 56th wedding anniversary. And someone said, wow, that's a long time, 56 years together. I said, it's been 56 wonderful years. I've heard people say that it doesn't matter, 50 years, 20 years were good, 30 years not so good. We think all 56 of ours have been wonderful. And we give our praise to God for how good he's been to us. We feel like he brought us together, kept us together. I think it's just one of the blessings of having laying down life to follow God, and it really blessed us. We found our life for us.
What about?
I just read this. I just told Nana this last night. The other day I read in Mark 8:38-39, I think it says, whoever holds on to his life will lose it. Whoever loses my life for my sake and the gospel will find it. And I think that's the lesson we learned. If someone holds on to their life and doesn't yield their life to God, you really lose the life that God wants for you. You might have a pretty good life and not the kind of life that God has for you. Jesus said that again, we might have life, have it abundantly. John chapter 10, verse 10. We believe we've had that abundant life that Jesus promised. So we believe we've lost our life in a way. I had a good job. When the Forest Service, I quit that job to go to Bible school to follow Christ to be a missionary. And so we gave up our life. I finished in the top part of my class in forestry school. And Emily graduated with honors all the way through college and high school. And we sort of put that aside. Follow Christ. We put that life aside to follow him and live on an Indian reservation in a mobile home with sort of limited income. When we first moved on to Douglas Lake Indian Reserve, our total income per month was $550 a month. That's not much money right now to live on. Some people make that much money almost a weekend. But that was back in 1972, a long time ago. So we've sort of given up the life that we thought was going to be good for the life that we thought God was calling us to, and God really blessed us. We've got a good marriage, wonderful friends. We love what we're doing. I'm a cheerleader for the college soccer game, and everybody there knows I love it. We get a lot of comments from the fans and the parents, and they have a lot of appreciation. In fact, when the women's team won the national championship 3 years ago, we went to the awards banquet, and they gave us a championship ring just because we meant so much to the team and to the parents. And Scout, this past, about a month ago, I think, the women's team played in the national championship game again, mm-hmm. This Division II women's soccer.
Yeah.
They played in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania for the national championship game. And I saw the video just before the game, one of the co-captains got the team in the huddle on the sideline. She got in the huddle, and this is on, I can show you this on video. This tall co-captain, Emily Nelson, she's, okay, girl, let's win this game. Play your best. Let's win this game for our parents and our friends. Let's win this game for our family. Let's don't let this team beat us now. Let's go out and win this game. 1, 2, 3, let's go. So even before the game, the captain of the team recognized us in the huddle and they wanted to win the game for us. That's how much they we mean to them. It's really an honor.
Yeah.
So God really loved doing what we do.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you think you could tell the story of how you just got involved with the soccer team, like the men's and women's programs?
Yeah, when we first moved from British Columbia to Seattle, to Bellingham, one of the goals was to give leadership to a Christian group on the campus at Western Washington University. It was a Christian group mainly of Asian students, mostly Korean students, South Koreans, and we'd recruited a lot of South Koreans to come up to be serving missionaries in British Columbia because the native people have a grudge against white people. A lot of native people say the white people took away our land, took away our language, put our residential schools, and just put us, it just really ruined our culture. But so they didn't like to hear the white people talk about the Bible too much, but when a couple of South Korean students came up from college in California 1 year, they would sit down with the Korean students and say, tell us what you believe about God. They were willing to listen to Koreans, but they weren't willing to listen to American or to white people. So we started recruiting more and more Korean students to come up from different colleges. Him and I went to several colleges on the West Coast, several colleges on the East Coast, recruit Koreans to come up and be summer missionaries because they were so effective outreach to the natives. So we knew there was a Korean group on the camps at Western, and we came down here. It's a long story, but just they just welcomed us with open arms. We said we'd like to live here and just give leadership to your group every week, help us out with the men, young men and women each week during the week. We did a lot of things with the students. And sometimes on the way to the meeting, I'd watch the soccer team practice. I really liked that because when in British Columbia, one of the places we lived, Seashell, they were really big into soccer. Their big sports was soccer and softball. Mm-hmm. So I watched a lot of soccer and I fell in love with the game. And so I started watching the Western men and women soccer practice and I started going to some of the games. And right near the end of that first year, I asked the head coach for the women's team, I said, you know, I really like enjoying watching this team. He said, you've been a good fan. I said, you know, I wish I could say something to the players. Right in the middle of practice, he blew the whistle. He said, okay, girl, everybody up here. He said, Ron wants to talk to you. And I said, oh, what is it, Ron? I said, well, I've enjoyed watching this practice. Said, we've been living in British Columbia for 3 years. And I said, it would be nice to watch soccer like this at your level. And I said, I'd like to invite everyone over to the house for appreciation dinner. The coach said, really? I said, yes. I said, just encourage the team. He told the girl to get back to practice. He said, Ron, you never get them all over there one night. I said, why? Yeah, these girls are so busy. They got games, practice, homework, part-time jobs, laundry, you know, all kind of activities, weight room. He said, I don't think you ever get them there on one night. So I said, okay, Derek, thanks for the encouragement. Well, I knew one of the girls on the team, so I sent an email. I said, Kristen, what do you think is the best night to buy a team over dinner? She texted me back a few days later. She said, how about such and such a night? So I wrote an email to every girl individually to invite them to their house for dinner. Every girl, out of about 30 girls, every girl except about four said they'd be glad to come. The four that weren't too enthusiastic. One of them said, it's my grandmother's funeral. One said, my sister's getting married. Another had some pretty good excuse why they couldn't come. Mm-hmm. I said, that's okay. We'll invite the whole team that night. But four of you that can't come, we'll have you four come over another night pretty soon after that. So the girls came that first night. They were all dressed up, you know, in their hair, nice and wearing dresses. It's kind of hard to recognize without their jerseys on, their number, the ponytail. Mm-hmm. They brought us flowers, and it just that first night, all we want to get across was that we love the team, we love Bellingham, and we love soccer. And one of the girls said, "What do you do this every year?" So this is the first. We'll do it every year. In fact, I remember the girl did that. She was a goalkeeper from Hawaii. Her name was Shea Anderson. I've got that on the wall. I kept a picture of all the teams and parents and. Mm-hmm. But I look at that picture once in a while. And Shay was the first one that said, you do this every year? I said, yes, we're going to do it every year. So it started in 1999, and we've done it every year. We just had the last ones recently. And it was really good for us. Now with the freshman players, boys or girls arrive for the first practice, and I think it's about the first part of August, something like that, when they arrive on the campus.
Yeah.
I go out to meet all the new players. I go out to meet all the new freshman boys and get their parents' names down. So I start learning who the parents are. As soon as they get on the campus, they'll say, you're the super fans. I said, that's what they call us. In fact, I've tried to get people to take over my cheerleading lately. And I've asked a couple of students I thought would be really good cheerleaders. And they said, Ron, we can't take your place. I said, why not? They said, you're the legend. Nobody can take your place. We've been faithful at it for a long time. It's been really good to build that relationship. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're glad to listen to what we have to say about our Christian faith. They know we love them. They know we come to all the games. They know we support them fully. We've got their back no matter what. We put a lot of time into building our relationship. We love doing it. And we've got good respect and response from the players and the parents.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
I've just got one more question. It's just kind of like, because I'm going to be going to college next year. So I was just kind of wondering what your college experience was like at Auburn and Georgia Tech, and if you have any like advice for me.
Let's see. It was kind of different both places. Auburn was on the football team. I lived in a cabin with three football players in the cabin with me, and the other side of the duplex cabin, the other side of the cabin with three football players and a thing in track and field man. It was sort of athletic cabins, and I would really get busy at practicing and training and all, but.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't spend enough time on my studies, but eventually I transferred to Georgia Tech, and I was living in a fraternity house. It was kind of a different setting, but I didn't spend enough time on my studies there either. It was, just too much social life and trying to get by. And then about that time, I started getting sleeping sickness. And, I think just pray and ask God to lead you and guide you, no matter what you want to do, and put your time in.
Okay. Thank you so much for letting me interview you.
Okay. Let me know how it goes.
Okay.